This is Alan Farley, and I'm with Dennis Norden, who is familiar to our listeners for many years as one of the participants in both My Word and My Music. Those shows, even though they have stopped producing new shows, continue to attract an audience and run and rerun.
Oh, that's nice.
Why don't we start? Let's see. My Word came first, didn't it?
Oh, yes. My Word came quite a few years. I'm very bad on dates, but I would say it was about 6 or 7 years before my music started here.
And how did it begin?
Well, it began with a man called Edward J. Mason, who wrote the most, among other things, the most successful daily soap over here, a soap that's actually still running and is tremendously successful, called The Archers, an everyday story of country folk. And he got together with a producer called Tony Shryan, because there wasn't at that time a literary quiz that was, as it were, geared down to what we would call over here, I don't know what your equivalent grade numbers are, but fifth form level. In other words, not when you're taking the important examinations that take you into university, but when you're on the run-up to them. Because of BBC budget, the idea of giving quotations from classical and popular literary works of the day was rather bounded by the fact they couldn't afford to pay any copyright fees, you see. So practically everything was out of copyright, which was good because it meant you covered the kind of things that kids were learning at school and that indeed we had learned at school. And I think the bedrock of the program was a book called Palgrave's Golden Treasury. Now, I don't know whether that's an American textbook. It was. I don't know whether it still is. The most popular book of English poetry. And it took in everybody from Chaucer up to about G.K. Chesterton, not much later than that. And I was fortunate in that I went to a school where the English teacher had said, now, the easiest way you're going to get through your exam is to learn this whole book. If you can do that. And, you know, when one's that age, you're just a walking bit of blotting paper.
Right.
That's a thing that'll puzzle a lot of today's listeners.
Yes.
Blotting paper, yeah. Look it up. And I searched it, and of course, bits of it, tags of it, and bits of it stay with you. And it sort of went from there.
You were among the first?
Yes. We were in the very first team, and stayed. Frank Muir and I, and the first chairman was a very popular cricket commentator, something else you don't have much of in
right.
the state, who was also by way of being a poet. A strange combination. A tremendously well-read man with a most attractive regional accent. And then we ran through a succession of chairmen, and among the first team members, besides Frank and me, were a novelist who was in her day a very highly thought of novelist. She's not read much today, called E. Arnott Robertson, a name which in itself brings back certain decades, and journalist and columnist called Nancy Spain, who died in a two-seater aircraft which crashed on the track of one of our most popular horse races of the year, the Grand National, and she And it was the way she was a rather flamboyant character, and it was very much in keeping. And so, you know, it ran down the years, and what started very early were the stories.
I was going to ask about that. Yeah. When did they start?
Well,
how did they start?
They started because they just wanted a change of the ordinary who said what and what does this mean and use this word in a sentence and what's the origin of and, you know, and so on. And it was simply to ring the changes on that. And they started what you might call very small because they were no more than two or three sentences. And gradually they became more and more elaborate and longer because as the years passed and as the listeners saw what the game demanded, as it were, the task became not to let them second guess us and to throw them off the scent, as it were, which demanded length. You know.
So they wound up, I guess, being, what, some 5 or 6, 7 minutes sometimes?
Yes, yes. They average, I think, not more than about 5.5 minutes. They seem long sometimes.
Well, then how did my music spin off?
Well, I suppose, insofar as we can use the word natural, it was a kind of natural consequence. Somebody said, why don't we do this with music? We didn't want to do it, Frank.
Well, I read Frank's autobiography just last year, yeah. How he's saying he didn't want to do it.
No, we felt we were totally unsuited for it. And in fact, in a way, it was an impertinence. Frank always knew more. He knew more about most things than I did, but he always knew more about music. And I sort of carved a role for myself as the sort of resident Philistine. I resolutely refused to try and learn anything, which wasn't difficult, actually, because I somehow have a resistance to classical music. I can remember rubbish songs, rubbish popular songs, the really third, fourth, fifth-rate popular songs stick in my head, and the great works just one ear and out the other.
Well, that show, too, while you didn't have a story, you had the party piece at the end where you got the same.
Yes, well, again, that I dodged completely because, you know, the other two on the team were always, in a sense, professional singers. They were, John Amos was a musicologist. He'd started as a professional singer. But couldn't learn the words. It's absolutely true. It was too much bother to learn the words. So he became a musicologist and one of our most eminent ones. Frank had much better, he could carry a tune better than I could. And one could sort of capitalize on skidding off the note every now and again for the first year or so, it soon became wearisome. And I thought, well, the thing to do is to distract listeners from my imperfections as a singer by concentrating on the lyrics. So I started looking for English comic songs and found very happily that there is a very good tradition of comics. We were very good at it for a very brief period of what we called the music hall, which was roughly coincident with vaudeville in America. But a lot of American artists took English comic songs and used them in their acts. And I went digging among that. And that became a very happy hobby, actually.
Well, now, you said that you and Frank didn't want to do the show. Mm. How did you finally get talked into it or roped into it?
There is a snake, or there was a snake of a producer, this Tony Shrine, who is the most insidious man. And before you know, if he wants something, before you know where you are, you've agreed to it, you know.
And so that wound up running for around 24 years or something.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah. Yes, it's very strange, actually, the way it became so much part of our lives. In the same way, I mean, my word ran longer. And that story every week, really, where it was a great part of our lives, they were very difficult. Well, we found them very difficult.
Now, you did have time to prepare
Well, we did finally.
Originally it was just during the show.
Oh, yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, and what stopped that dead in its tracks was that while that is possible, I mean, you know, we were much younger and we didn't have the sense to know it was impossible. You know, so, but before we matured into it, what you don't have time to do is you don't have time to have second thoughts. In other words, you can't reject it. You can't, an idea will come into the head and you can't, there isn't time to think to yourself, well, no, I won't do that because it's not quite good enough or it's dangerous. You have to take that thought and go with it, you see. And occasionally they turned out a little bit blue for the, you know, blue, do you,
yes,
you use
yes.
it in that sense, yeah, for the BBC. And that's the best way to at that time to stop, get the BBC to change its mind. And they came to sort of a great to-do and said, look, some of these are they're not really suitable, you know. And we said, well, that's it. I mean, we can think of one story, but the idea of having a selection of stories and mentally running through and say which is most suitable for is out of the question. And they said, well, you we'll give you the lines beforehand. And you can work on them then. And in return for that, as it were, we felt it incumbent upon us to therefore make the stories, to give the stories that little extra bit of tortuousness or whatever the noun for that is. And so they became a thing that was an incubus. We both used to wake up at nights in the middle of the night and with twisted phrases going through our mind, you know, and we'd ring up and without it saying hello, or you know, we'd ring up and say, I don't know, give me anything. You can't have your cork and hate, and the other one would say, tattoo. I mean, to anybody listening, it was you know, minds at the end of their tether, and but it got like that at the end of each series. And there was no holiday from it. And at the end, I think it got a bit too much, actually.
Well, now you and Frank had worked together as comedy writers before the series, and either the series began.
Yeah.
How did you first meet and start working together?
Well, that now we're really delving back into history. This is before the coming of the railways. You know? this is really way back, just after the Second World War. We were both in the Royal Air Force, and there was a wonderful man over here who set up a kind of writers' cooperative for people coming out of the services and wanting to go into radio writing, which was the only game in town, because television, while it had started over here before the war in 1936, and had gathered a little following, not a lot, it must have been wonderful in those days. They would invite all the viewers to a tea party. Yes, they once a year. I did a book about it, actually, because it was such an enchanted sort of period of entertainment. But it was only radio for a while. And that was, if you wanted to write that kind of stuff, it was the only way to go. And we both met under the aegis of this man who, for you know, and somebody put us together for a program. We'd both been writing separately, and then we kind of moved in together, you know.
Well, now you perform as well.
Well, I don't think it's performing, actually. I perform like a writer, you know. What happens is, I suppose, that our humour was always quite gentle. And humour got harder and tougher. And it got to the point where the only people who would perform the kind of stuff we wrote would be ourselves, you know, and while we could find a vehicle for it, comedians as such wanted rather harder-edged material. And so we got into that line of country.
Well, you also host an annual television special of outtakes?
Yes, well, I started that. It was picked up by Dick Clark, with whom we had a very good relationship. But the first outtake show was the one that I did here, and we've been doing one a year now for going on 23 years.
So oh my.
It really goes back that far. I mean, it was very strange, actually, because the whole birth of it was something that just couldn't happen in television these days. I was having tea in the commissary of a television studio with a producer, and we were talking about an outtake that we'd seen and we laughed at. And very casually I said, or he said, or one of us said, one of us ever been a show about what's all outtakes? And we both suddenly froze. And we said, would it work? Now, in the commissary, we went to the phone, we rang up the guy who was, as it were, the head of the studio, head of the network for comedy, entertainment. Can we come up and see? We may have an idea here. Come up. So we go to his office, straight up from the commissary, and say, Michael Grade, his name was, and what do you think the idea of a show that's all outtakes? Like a beat, moment's pause, and he says, how soon can you let me have it? Now, that was it. Now, today, when you think of the committees and the little, all the judges and the critics and the people it would have to go through, it would take you a year to get that off the ground. That literally was within 5 minutes. We went up in the, what we quaintly call the lift, and came down again with the show, you know. It the whole birth of it was quaint.
In the States now, I think it's being done to death, and some shows, at the end of every show,
that's right,
play some outtakes as a that's background right. for their credits.
It makes life very difficult for us who are trying to put it together.
But you collect from all over the world.
All over the world, yes. It's become an international currency, possibly the only currency that isn't in trouble today, you know? And which is very strange, because it means that an actor who does something he shouldn't, makes a mistake in some way, say over here, and he does something which isn't particularly verbal maybe, but it's funny, we'll do it, then our sort of colleagues in Japan will see it, can we do it, yes, and they'll do it in their show, and the actor will get paid again. And then in the States, all over the States, Canada, Australia, France, Germany, and he'll get maybe 12 fees for doing something wrong. So that in the end, he will make more by having malperformed than he would if he'd done it correctly. I remember saying once about it, it's like being a farmer where eventually the manure gets worth more than the cattle.
or being paid to plow stuff in and not
produce
it.
That's right.
We're talking with Dennis Norden, a cast member for many years of both My Word and My Music. And did you always want to be a writer?
Yes, I did. I don't think I always wanted to be this kind of a writer. I think I had grander notions. When I went to school in London, I learned Spanish, which wasn't popular. You know, most people over here were taking French or German, but the Spanish somehow appealed to me, and the Spanish Civil War was on. And I had great dreams of being a foreign correspondent, mainly because I saw a film with Joel McRae in which he played a foreign correspondent.
Called Foreign Correspondent.
Foreign Correspondent, yes. The scene with the umbrellas, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think as much as anything, it was the fact that he wore a belted trench coat with epaulettes, you know, and that's the kind of thing that forms a career. So I'm speaking Spanish. I went and did translation. I was only about 13 or 12, 13, I don't know, something like that. For Spanish refugees over here. And then I wrote to a very distinguished foreign correspondent of one of our national newspapers and told him my minute CV, you know. And he said, well, I'll take you on as an apprentice. And so I went to my parents' great glee and said, this guy's name is Sefton Delma. Sefton Delma is willing to take me on. I'll go to Spain, where the war was raging, you know. And my parents said, as I would today if one of my kids came, you know, forget it. You finish your school, you know. Wait. And so in pique, I finished school, didn't go on to university, and went straight into a theatre as a boiler man, actually, you know, cleaning the boilers. Simply, it was a childish sort of thing to do. And then that got me sort of pointing towards entertainment. But I was originally going to be one of the greatest journalists that you ever saw, you know.
Well, you've worked for both the BBC and for private television.
ITV, yes. It's independent. They call it independent.
Much,
I don't know what it's independent
of. Is there much difference?
Not money, you know. No. Virtually, I mean, both of them will hotly deny this, but from the point of view of the labourer in the vineyard, very, very little difference. The BBC is a noble institution. I mean, it's you get people in the BBC that you seldom get in ITV, as it's called, independent television. There's a kind of dedication and a willingness to go the extra mile, you know, all that sort of thing, and nourish talent that possibly a more commercial station can't afford to do. So there isn't a tradition of it, you see. But it is admirable.
One of the things that I do for the radio station is I've done a series of programs on Noel Coward's songs, and I do an annual birthday special.
Yes.
And also, between my word and my music every week, I do a Noel Coward song.
Right.
Which I try to relate to the show, because right. Originally when we got the shows, we had to put something in between them.
Yeah.
And someone suggested, why don't you do a Noel Coward song? So I've been doing that now for 4 or 5 years. I'm just wondering if there are any particular favorites of yours, or did you ever meet Coward?
Yes, we did, actually, in a My Word context, as it were, because I mentioned this lady, Nancy Spain, very flamboyant lady, and she used to have wonderful parties, and we went, and she was on the team, and she invited Frank and me and our families to a party, which were very simple. It wasn't dressed up, one of the dressing up things. It was just fun. And there were all sorts of people there, including her neighborhood greengrocer, who was a great pianist. And he played piano, and suddenly in came Noel Coward, who just sat about, put his feet up, and so utterly relaxed. And the greengrocer was at the piano, started playing some Coward songs. So Coward, as he would, came and sat next to him, and they went through the Coward canon together in this suburban room. And when Coward forgot the words, the greengrocer knew them. And Coward was immensely chuffed, as we call it. He was really, delighted with this. And the spectacle of the two of them sitting there is something you don't easily forget.
Are there any? What are your favorites of his songs?
I like the one, Why Do the
Wrong People Travel?
Wrong People Travel, yeah. And I particularly like Elaine Stritch's.
Oh, yes, yes.
Of that.
Yes, there's a chance that I think she may be doing a gala concert version of Sail Away next year.
Really?
As part of the centennial.
Yes.
Yeah, she's terrific.
He wears awfully well, actually. The songs wear awfully well, and I think they'll come back. In a funny way, I've just been reading a new biography of Cole Porter, in which it's an excellent biography, and I'm ashamed of myself for not remembering the name of the writer. But they reprint a lot of Cole Porter's lyrics. And in a strange way, they don't stand up the way that cowards do. They are more sentimental. I mean, he does have that same edge, but Coward sort of undercuts the sentiment a lot, doesn't he?
Yes. Oh, I know someone else I'd like to ask you about is Hutch.
Oh, yes.
Did you know Hutch?
Yes.
Because I have, through looking for Coward recordings, came across Coward recordings, and also knowing Norman Hackforth.
Yes.
Who worked with Coward, and Hutch had recorded some of his songs, and trying to track those down, I started collecting all the Hutch I could find. I've got about 5 CDs now. And yet I don't know an awful lot about the man, and just sort of the sketches of his biography.
Well, he in his time, Hutch was the darling of cafe society. I mean, I don't know how much I'm telling you the obvious things that you know. It was a very mannered way of singing, actually, in which he enunciated and rolled his R's. That's such a night. The night. I mean, they were parallel in that they clipped their words off Cowan and Hutch. He had a rather racy reputation because he was a very, very handsome man. He had a white handkerchief. Do you know this? Well,
no.
It's as much associated with him as it is with, say, Louis Armstrong. And in fact, the impersonators, the impressionists of that day would make a white handkerchief do duty for doing a Hutch impression and an Armstrong. So they go from the one voice to the other and use their... But he would flick delicately with the handkerchief. And I mean, I was at one time a manager of what we called a variety theatre, you know, Vaudeville House, you know. And he was a top-of-the-bill man, and we played him several times. And the standard of womanhood thronging the stage door was very, very high, and he was a man of immense vitality as well, and a lot of sort of satisfied ladies were leaving. He sang some rather low-grade songs. He wasn't greatly discriminating. He was apparently a better piano player than most people give him credit for. Not being a musician, I don't know. But people have said to me that he was an interesting... Most of his records have he plays a half chorus on the piano. And apparently that's interesting, too. Pianist, but he was the number one plug, as they call it. If you got Hutch to do your song, you were selling a certain number of copies.
Are you writing today? Working on something today?
This very day.
This very day?
Yes. Well, I do all sorts of ragtag bobtail things. I mean, I have a. I do about 3 or 4 television specials every year. Besides, this is in addition to the outtake show. So I've got, and they take months to look through. They're all what we call clip shows, little bits and pieces. I've just finished one about award shows. You know, or everything except the Oscars, who won't release any of their material, but the Tonys and the Golden Globes and the English equivalents and French ones and so on, and moments from all of them. Because in every award show, there's one good moment, and
yes.
Then amid those arid deserts
of hours, yes.
It's like, you know, somebody said that every musical that's open, there's always one good moment in it, and the people put together collections of that. Well, done one of those, and I'm just sort of sorting out one of those kind of shows now.
Well, it's really a delight to meet you. I've enjoyed your work for many years,
and I would speak for Frank, in our appreciation of what you've done to keep those past shows on the air. It's really wonderful.
Well, you know, a couple of years ago, the shows distributed by a station in Chicago, WFMT. Mm. And they informed us, oh, we're going to stop, because there aren't any new shows, we're going to stop rerunning them. Mm. Well, the uproar was really? So great, they said, oh, well, I'm sorry, we'll keep going.
Thank you.
So at least for a couple more years. And I mean, my idea was if they stopped, then we would pick it up, because I know that there are people out there, they don't care if they've heard them before. But with around 500 shows per series, I mean, you can go 10 years without a repeat.
Right, yeah.
So it's a great series and has a devoted following, and I appreciate having the chance to talk with you about
it. Thank you very much.